Oh.
Work hard, play hard. Welcome again to Work It Out with Mercy Quay, the show about what people do for work, at work, and what motivates them in life. I'm talking to people who have left their 9-to-5s to turn their passions into 24/7s, as well as folks who have ditched the status quo altogether to define their own brand of success and happiness outside the mold. Consider this your Monday motivation and your weekly inspiration to find what makes you happy and figure out how to work it out. With me here today is James Hart, who is a friend of mine and is doing what I think is really relatable, like a bunch of really relatable things. And I just want to say, when I started toying around with the idea of the show, I wanted to talk to people from all sort of walks of life as it pertains to, you know, races, cultures, and creeds, sure, but also kind of defining success in their own right and literally just working it out, which is what inspires the name of the show. And my friend James is here because I think James is a really good example, especially in this time of year, of someone who is literally just doing all of the things that he likes and is good at. Would you say that's right, James?
I think, yeah, that sounds about right. Trying anyway.
Yeah.
Trying.
So tell me a bit about the things that you're doing to work it out, whatever it may be.
Okay. So my primary mode of employment is that I work for a small nonprofit summer camp that's based out of New Hampshire. And I am their director of development. So, you know, trying to get money from...
Just trying to get money.
Yeah. Yeah. Trying to get money for the camp. And I do a lot of like alumni engagement type of stuff. Everything from like event planning, communications, marketing, a little bit of everything. And I guess the bonus for that is twofold. One, that I can work remotely most of the year. And then for 2 months a year, I go up to New Hampshire and live on a lake.
Because the camp is in New Hampshire.
It's in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. Yes. But I live in New Haven. I just bought a house.
Yeah.
New Haven. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I am an adjunct professor at the University of New Haven in the political science department, and more recently in the Masters of Public Administration program.
And what else do you do? Because those are two things. And in my head, I feel like you don't just do two things in life. I feel like you do everything. I feel like whatever I'm not doing, you're doing. So between the two of us, we got everything covered.
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment, I guess. I mean, I guess as long as I can remember, I've always felt the need to like have a side hustle, mostly because I've just been super broke my entire life. So I've always needed to find some extra money. So I do all kinds of I do like handyman style services for some of the professors that I work with.
Yeah.
I do, a little bit of anything. This year I recently started doing a little bit of like pro bono, nonprofit consulting, trying to help like really small nonprofits who can't afford development professionals to kind of help them go through like their communication rhythms and stuff
awesome.
Like that. I had to learn from scratch. So yeah, it's been fun. So yeah, a little bit of everything.
And I think the reason that is relatable is that it really does just speak to the purpose of this show in that, right? I think in the first few months of doing this show, what I've been doing is focusing on folks who are like, you know, years of executive director experience or just hopping out of the 9-to-5 block and doing kind of like their own thing for the first time. And the reason I, you know, brought you on, especially in December, is I think that like what you do really just speaks to the spirit of like, especially this time of year, just like kind of being a regular person, but also in that doing some really cool and interesting things. So tell me a little bit more about the camp.
Okay, so Camp Mowgli has been around for a really long time, started in 1903, and we're a small, pretty traditional nonprofit boys summer camp, mm-hmm. And I should say it's a camp for boys. We're pretty old school in that, you know, we teach our boys things like how to use an axe, how to survive in the wilderness, and it's completely...
How do you use an axe?
Well... and it's completely tech-free. So we've sort of found a little bit, a little bit of a renewed, relevance, I guess, in the modern age. Got it.
Yep.
And, And I'd say, I mean, in terms of as a development professional, I would say my job is more on par with something that you might find in like a small private school or even like a small university where, you know, our alumni, I think, treat the experience as something that was pretty significant in their lives. So most of my job is just like talking with these people and just connecting with them, creating events and opportunities to sort of keep them, let them know how things are going. And then in the summer, I get to be there and I get to help teach things and I get to do all the fun stuff. I get to, you know, do the hiking and the canoeing and all that fun.
Yeah. Stuff too, so like there's something really just like inspirational about what you do for 3 to 4 months out of the year, right? Like, I think you're living the dream in that like people, especially those who work the 9-to-5 block, like really are interested in ditching that for the summer in the way that we're taught that we can from, you know, a young age and in school, right? That you really only work from September to June, and then the months in between you go on vacation, and then we became adults and we realized that that's not true.
Nope. Yep.
But I think you found a way to make that true for you.
I mean, it's so interesting because like when I'm at camp, don't get me wrong, it is a 24-hour job, but it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. But it's great. It's super fulfilling. And then in the rest of the year, there's a huge ebb and flow. And I mean, you've obviously had quite a bit of experience working for nonprofits, and obviously one of the real pros to that is that, generally speaking, if you really like the cause of the nonprofit that you mm-hmm. work for, you get to, you know, make a living and also like do something that makes you feel good.
Yeah.
And what I've found a way is to take those 2 months of the summer that I love, and while I'm at camp, and do that, and now I get to do it all the time in different ways.
Yeah. What does this camp look like during the fall and winter months, though?
Oh, it's so beautiful. I mean, it's just these incredibly beautiful old buildings covered in snow. It's kind of eerie when it's super empty, but it's cool. And I've gotten to learn so much more about, you know, the nonprofit sector. I mean, mm-hmm. I didn't realize how significant the industry was. I didn't realize that summer camps were a multi-billion-dollar industry. There's so much I didn't know.
Yeah. Tell me about like one of the specific things that surprised you, because you went to this camp.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And yeah, like you came up through this camp from sure. like a wee bit of a man to a taller wee bit of a man.
Beard. Got a beard.
Exactly.
So I think the biggest thing is that, you know, so as a kid, my folks didn't have a lot of money. There was no way we would have been able to afford for me to go to a camp. And I was able to go there on a scholarship. And I think as I've gotten older and I've seen other boys coming through on scholarships and seen what that brings to the camp, it's definitely given me something of a sort of motivating an impetus to really sort of drive some of mm-hmm. what I do. You know, unfortunately, summer camp, you know, when you think of it, it's like a bunch of white people on a lake, right? And
which is very scary for me, I have to say.
No, absolutely.
The first time I went to see you, and full disclosure, my partner also works at this camp. And at the end of summer, they gather all of the boys and all of these white men, because this is an old boys camp, paint themselves in either red or blue paint, and they battle royale somewhat to the death, not to the death, but like in a canoe race, mm-hmm. right? And so like, to be stereotypical for a moment, and just for a moment, and no one repeat this, right? Like,
no.
Those are two things that make black people very afraid. Mm-hmm. White men and water.
Yeah. Oh, and then throw in the giant fires, too.
And the bonfire that looks, I mean, it's crazy.
And we teach the kids to shoot. Yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff that could definitely...
Like, I feel like I shouldn't come. Like...
Well, and that's so one of the things that I realized was, and even speaking with some of like, you know, as a nonprofit, you know, we've got our board of trustees, board of directors, and, you know, even speaking with some of them who came as kids on scholarship, and it gives them a real appreciation for, you know, what the sort of summer camp experience offers for young people. And the cool part is that we know, you know, research tells us now that, you know, summer camp is quite literally in whatever form, be it day camp, overnight camp, long distance, sleep away, whatever, is literally good for every single child.
Yeah,
and that our country would genuinely be a better place if every single kid had
the opportunity,
camp, at least
yeah.
had the chance to go. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we've seen recently is we've made a concerted effort to really grow our scholarship and our scholarship program, so that way we can, you know, really bump up the not just racial but socioeconomic diversity at our camp, because we really just think that that brings so much to the table. It benefits all the kids. You know, yeah. It's better for the kids that might not otherwise be able to afford it to have the opportunity. It's better for some of these kids that come from more affluent backgrounds to know that, like, that's not how everybody lives.
Right.
And when you're 12, you don't necessarily know that.
Yeah.
You know? And that's, I'd say that's the thing that opened my eyes as much. I thought that since I got the scholarship to go to this like really wonderful camp that changed my life, that every kid has that, and they don't.
Yeah.
And a lot of parents, I think, that would like to send their kids to camps don't necessarily realize that it's just like school, like all kinds of schools and programs. There is money out there to be had to send your kid to camp, but
yeah,
it's not everyone knows that.
Yeah. So I skipped over a question I asked you a bit ago, which was what are some of the super, I guess, maybe important or sort of the things that kind of took you aback a little bit that you learned from transitioning from camper to employee to now assistant director and development director for the organization?
Yeah. You know, as a kid, it all seems so seamless. You know, camp is just this, it's a 7-week residential camp, no technology, right? So it seems like it's this remarkably well orchestrated, everything is seamless, and you just have no clue how much goes on behind the scenes. All the training that the staff goes through, all the stuff that they have to do,
yeah,
trying to cram, creating new activities and ideas and things in like your already non-existent time. You don't have any extra time. And then and to watch some of these staff, and some of these folks, you know, went to the camp. Some of them didn't. Some of them just like are just people from, you know, Spain or England or wherever, and who just applied.
You guys have people from like everywhere,
and we have kids from everywhere too. So you get these people that just get dropped in, maybe don't even have a particularly strong mastery of English, you know, and then we're like, okay, here, create a game for 120 7 to 14-year-olds to do, and no one can get hurt.
And everyone can understand each other.
Yeah, and it'll be fun.
Good time.
Yeah. It's and watching that effort and watching how it all comes together, and as the team sort of like the staff kind of come together throughout the summer, it's just the coolest thing to watch.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I just feel like,
They don't get paid a lot.
Yeah,
they do not get paid a lot. So like they're so often going above and beyond, and most of them, you know, they're college students or whatever, and for the most part. But it's still a lot to ask of people, and they really tend to rise.
So that actually gets to the heart of the purpose of the show, which is how does someone work that kind of thing out, right? Like not just you, some of the other employees as well have figured out how to realize what we've been taught as children, that you only work from, you know, late August to June,
mm-hmm.
and then the rest of the months are summer months for vacation.
Sure.
You guys have made that true, but now you're saying you don't, you know, they're not paid a lot. A lot of it is, you know, they're hard hours, yep. No technology.
Mm-hmm.
How do you work that out?
So I think if you're a younger person, right, maybe you're high school age or you're in college or and you're in that like age bracket, it makes sense. You know, you go to school, you know, fall, winter, spring, cool. You got your summers off. So it's a great way to make some extra money, get a really cool experience, meet some different kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
Get to do a bunch of fun stuff, you know, get to know the kids and all that. Now, once you, I think, like break that, once you're outside of that and you're trying to be, you know, trying to have a regular-ish job, whatever that means, that's where it gets really hard.
Yeah.
And I mean, unless you work in, let's say, like education, mm-hmm. you know, like my job at the university works great because I've got a month of padding on either end of camp starting and ending, and
mm-hmm.
it's fine. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
really interfere.
Mm-hmm.
Or
if you are, you know, a teacher and in your contract you're paid mm-hmm. during the summer or something like that.
Yeah. Or hopefully you make enough that, you know, even though it's not a ton. And I mean, that's one of the real challenges I think that a lot of summer camps face is that, you know, typically, especially if you're a nonprofit, you don't necessarily have the money to, you know, maintain like a 16-person year-round budget, right? Or year-round staff. So you end up with like a handful of people, like many nonprofits, that wear a bunch of hats and have 15 different titles and jobs. But it's definitely a struggle to maintain like summer, like quote unquote, sort of like management team that has multi-summer like viability, you know, because, you know, if you get offered that job or whatever, like how many jobs do you get your summers off? You know, outside of education, I can't really think of many.
Unless you do
seasonal work all year long, maybe like, I don't know.
I mean, I don't. This is like one of the things that I'll be jealous of for like the rest of my life. And for the rest of my knowing you, I will always be jealous.
It is. I will say, though, it is hard.
Yeah, too. I mean,
like, because the whole uprooting.
Uprooting yourself for the. Oh, right. Let's talk about this.
Yeah. It's
so the name of the camp is Mowgli,
mm-hmm.
which is after.
The Jungle Book.
The Jungle Book.
Yep.
And the mission is to it right. I think that the is a slogan like the Camp of the Wild or like
a School of the Open. Yeah,
School of the Open. Yep. School of the Open. And when you visit Mowgli on, is it Mowgli Road?
Mowgli Drive, yep.
On Mowgli Drive in Hebron, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm, middle of nowhere. Yep.
Middle of nowhere.
Yep.
What you find is the camp, a gas station, a Dunkin' Donuts, because because New England.
It's New England, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
mandatory.
And that's about it.
That's about it, yeah.
So, again, how do you work that out? I mean, this is an uprooting to your point,
mm-hmm.
coming from New Haven, going back to New Hampshire, because even though you're from New Hampshire, even though you're from New Hampshire.
I've lived almost half my life in New Haven. So, I mean,
exactly.
I'm a transplant.
With restaurants and technology and diversity.
Uber's a big, that's huge, yeah.
Right? How does that... What's the trade-off, and is it worth it?
It's gotten increasingly easier, although I don't know if it's really gotten easier or if we've just gotten more accustomed to it. You know, when I first went back to Mowgli, it was after I got out of the military, and it fit great. I was in grad school. It was fine. I had my summers off. It was a great fit, and I was working with kids. It fit. I was getting my master's in education. It was perfect fit. But what we were still doing is, like, you know, having to, you know, pay rent on an apartment if we couldn't sublet or get out of the lease. We're dealing with all these costs, or there's two different summers where we had to like pack up all of our stuff and put it mm-hmm. in storage.
Yeah.
And then you go back and it's the end of this exhausting summer. And the last thing you want to do is load up a U-Haul and move into some, you know, third floor apartment or whatever. So I think now that we bought a house, it'll be a little easier.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it definitely brings challenges. And my fiance, I should say, obviously works at the camp with me in the summers, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And she luckily works in a job where she freelances, so it fits for her too. But
right.
But then you go up there, and there's like I would say three huge differences that like hit me almost immediately. Is one is that it's just all white people, like exclusively white people.
Yeah.
And that was something I experienced even as a kid growing up. I grew up in a pretty close to where the camp is, so a pretty whitewashed, you know, part of the state. I think the other is just like what's there. There's just not a lot there. Like
mm-hmm.
you want to go out to eat on a Sunday and it's 9 o'clock, you might be up the creek. Like
right.
9 o'clock on a Sunday is pretty much bedtime.
And up the creek is kind of literal because you might have to go fishing.
Yeah. and then I think the last part though is a good thing though, which is it's just like the space and the quiet. And it's you've been up there. I mean, it's
yeah.
a beautiful, beautiful area. And that is, I don't know, it is really nice to be able to like drive down the road and there's no trash on the streets. Like there's no
that
like,
is very nice.
Some of the crummy parts of urbanization, you know, whenever you're like I drive across the Kew Bridge every day to go home now and like you smell that kind of like
industrialism.
That like rubble, that like burnt rubber kind of mm-hmm. smell coming off the harbor. And like
that's because the oil tanks are there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean you smell that in New Hampshire if like your brakes are burning or something.
Right.
Like that's about it.
Right. The trade off is worth it, absolutely.
I think so.
Do you think you can make it a full time thing?
I mean
you're making it a full time thing now remotely. Do you think
sure.
you can make New Hampshire a full time thing at Mowgli?
Yeah, I mean
with nothing around you.
To be perfectly honest, you know, the older I get, the less of a taste I have sometimes for sort of the pace of a more urban environment.
Yeah.
So I could definitely see, like right now I'm still in the part where I genuinely enjoy it. I like that I can, you know, I can pick from 15 different Indian places to get Uber Eats to my house. You know, I love that I can go
cute.
Down the street and see a Van Gogh for free. You know,
mm-hmm.
I love that I can experience music and culture and diversity right outside my front door. And that's really amazing. And that is inherently not existent in all parts of New Hampshire. I mean, granted, you get out to like the seacoast in southern New Hampshire
sure.
and it looks a lot more like a suburb of Boston than
right,
it does anything
right.
else. But
because to some degree it is.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I mean, people are moving there left and right. I would be really surprised if I did not end up like heading up that way at some point in maybe the next 10 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if you're just joining us, you are listening to Work It Out with Mercy Quay. I'm Mercy Quay. That's James Hart over there on WNHH Radio, broadcasting at 103.5 FM and live streamed at the newhavenindependent.org and also New Haven Independent's Facebook page. I just mentioned that is James Hart over there, a buddy of mine who is, I think, so what I put here on the screen, and James and I sort of texted back and forth last night, like, well, what do we call you? Do we go by the camp name or the, you know, professor? What are we calling you? And what we decided on was Dude of All Trades. And I think that's appropriate. because James is sort of making a lot of things happen for himself and really just finding and defining happiness for himself in a lot of ways. Right now we're talking about his involvement with Mowgli, a summer camp for boys up in New Hampshire, where he spends 3 months of the year there full-time and now works full-time as the development director, mm-hmm. Remotely from here in New Haven. James, tell me, because I know that you, like I said, you grew up through the camp system. What is something that someone who didn't go to camp, whether overnight or at all, right, would be surprised to know about camp lifers?
We're not actually cults. There aren't. I mean, maybe some of them are.
I was going to say, wait a second. We just talked about bonfires and blue and red paint.
Oh, it can definitely seem kind of, I think the thing is that, you know, I think every camp, just like, I think even to a certain extent, universities and stuff do the same thing. They have their own sort of cultural things and sort of traditions and stuff, which to an outsider, you know, I'm sure at times seem kind of crazy. And I think any really good camp that's been around for a while is going to be sort of steeped in tradition to a certain extent. And, mm-hmm. you know, if you have an experience, then they can probably seem pretty wonky. But I think that ultimately they're part of what makes the experience. Is it you have this environment where, like, for example, you know, we take, you know, young men, and, you know, young men have typically exhibit a lot of behaviors that are not super great. You know, they're loud and they're not always nice to each other.
They're
smelly. They have to touch each other all the time, and they always have to be pushing each other
and smelly.
Each other, and they smell.
Okay. Just one for the record.
And then we get to, you know, because of that sort of insulation of all of our, you know, sort of rules and structures and traditions, we get to impart on them some life lessons that are pretty huge. Like, here you are, you know, you're 12 years old, and our primary focus is to help you be a gentleman, help you just to be a good human being and to treat each other with respect, take care of the world around you, take care of the people around you. And that's, I think that's why that sort of insular kind of tradition and stuff, I think that's why it works.
Yeah.
And where if you're you know, looking at it from the outside, you're like, what? That's it. They're dancing and singing weird songs in a made-up language or whatever.
Can you give
me
one of the weird songs?
No, please, I can't. No, please. No, I don't think so.
There one that's like "Mowgli is a life for me" or something like that?
No.
Did I just make that up?
Yeah. Okay. That's okay. That's okay. I mean, most of them don't really make a lot of sense anyway, but that's okay.
I feel like I was pretty close. I don't know.
But I guess my point is we try to take advantage of those traditions and use them as a mechanism to deliver a message that's hard. You know, that's hard. You know, when you got definitely easier when you take their phone away, though.
true. So, because I think Mowgli over the past, I'll say 10 years, has been seeing a spike in diversity, whether socioeconomic, racial, you know, creed, whatever.
Mm-hmm, sure.
What are some of the difficulties that you've experienced, and what are some of the richness, like the stories of richness that come from that?
I think, okay, so one of the challenges is because we're so small, you know, we don't have, you take like a university, for example, if they decide that they want to set their minds to increasing diversity, it's relatively easy because they have such a huge applicant pool typically, right? So all they have to do is kind of re-gear their approach to, you know, but for us, it's not the same. And I think, you know, and it's, and I'm cautious saying this as a, you know, New Hampshire and white dude.
I think we're supposed to whisper white
days.
Yeah.
What?
As a white man.
As a white dude. No, I wonder, and this is just, you know, I didn't work in public ed for a long time, but both the schools that I worked at, you know, were very diverse. And the kids that I worked with knew what I did in the summers. And I don't think for many of them, they thought of something like summer camp as an option.
Mm.
And I imagine that for many of them, their parents might not have either.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see where there's sort of a disconnect and maybe even perhaps like a little bit of discomfort. Like if you're a parent raising a kid in New Haven, maybe you haven't spent a ton of time outside, like doing that kind of stuff. You go and you go to this website and you see kids with axes in their hands and they're, you know, swimming and shooting guns, like all kinds of things, you know, and you're like, what? What? No.
That's,
you know.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the challenges that we face is being able to connect with, I think, some of the communities that would benefit most from having their kids have the experience.
Exposure.
Now, on the like heartwarming, awesome, touchy-feely side, I think the best part is that, you know, you get kids, and we have a mix. You know, we have a pretty good mix of kids who are like more rural, affluent, urban affluent, urban, you know, more poor, you know, every, like a little bit of everything. And I think the part that makes me really happy is when you see kids who, you know, I've seen their applications. I know that their backgrounds couldn't be more different.
Mm-hmm.
And to see them just be attached at the hip, mm-hmm. like none of that other stuff matters, is kind of refreshing. You know, it's because the only reason that they like each other is just because they like each other.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, like, they're not looking at each other. Like, we have uniforms and stuff. So it's like the clothes that they're wearing doesn't matter. You know, there's not a ton of dividing lines, socioeconomic or otherwise.
Everyone's thrown into sort of like the barracks.
And they all have to do the same crazy stuff. Yeah. Like, you got to go hike Mount Washington and it's pouring rain the whole time.
Yep.
It doesn't matter where you come from. That's a hard experience. And there's a little bit of, you know, camaraderie, I think, that gets built out of that. I think the barracks thing is a really apt.
And I think it pulls into your experience in the military,
mm-hmm.
right? Sort of like this equalizing factor of, regardless of what, you know, where we came from or what background we have, we are thrown into the same barracks.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. You're all basically on the same foot.
Yeah. How do you think the kids take it? Like, I know that you said there is a lot of, right, the camaraderie is built sort of not even knowing that they could be more different.
Mm.
What do you think are the major lessons that they pull from that? The kids who are put on scholarship.
Sure.
And the kids who come from, you know.
Millions.
Sure. And ski the Alps mm-hmm. regularly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think for them, I'm not going to say that they don't realize it. You know, I'm not going to say that a kid that comes from, whose parents are really wealthy, doesn't know that their friend doesn't have the same opportunities. You know, you talk about Christmas and you talk about what you got for presents and, like, you know, you got 4 video game systems and he's like, oh yeah, I got like a hat and some gloves, you know?
Yeah.
And you catch those things. And I think the older they get, the more aware they are of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's so irrelevant in the context of mm-hmm. camp. I think that's the cool part about mm-hmm. camp, is that it is like this Never Neverland sort of thing.
Oh gosh!
Like
Never Neverland is about a story about a boy who never grew up.
Yeah. No. Exactly. Well, and that's why I have alumni who are. I was just on the phone with an alumnus who was 92 years old.
He was, or he is.
He is. He's currently 92 okay. years old. And was at Mowgli in the late 30s and 40s.
Oh wow.
And he called me and he was asking about, like, he had a list of things. And he was like, Chip, you know, I need to know, here's a list of 10 things. I need to make sure you still do all these things at camp. And I was really excited to be able to tell him that we did literally all of them.
Oh, wow.
And so I think the uniqueness of the experience creates a bond.
Mm-hmm.
So even when I see alumni come back and you see someone who, you know, guys who came from very different backgrounds, you know, all thrown in a mix with varying levels of, you know, maybe professional success or whatever the case may be. And you can still see them, you'll sit down and talk for hours about, you know, like pranks that they pulled on each other and like shenanigans that they got into and really hard trips that sucked where they got soaked in the rain for 3 days or whatever the case may be. So I think for the kids, it's as long as they buy in, and not all of them do. For some of them, it's not a good fit.
At some point, I want you to tell me about the ones who don't buy in, but go ahead.
But I think, you know, once they buy in, it's like, it's something that they'll remember for the rest of their lives.
And what of the ones that don't?
Sure. So let's face it, you know, taking your phone away. We have a very, you know, as I'm sure Jesse's made you familiar with.
Jesse's my partner's name.
You know, we have a very regimented schedule,
mm-hmm.
very sort of military-like. You know, the kids have to clean up for them after themselves. It's not a vacation camp. You know, they are, you know, like there's days where the kids, like, we have a rotating schedule of duties, of responsibilities for the kids. And some days, that's no big deal. Some days it's setting the table. Some days it's cleaning toilets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no technology. So, you know, no phones, no video games, no nothing, right? They're hiking. They're outside basically all the time, whether it's hot, whether it's cold, whether it's raining, whatever. And that's not always the right fit for some kids. Some kids just don't like it. Now, I'm happy to say that, you know, at Mowgli, generally speaking, it's very, very rare.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have some tough cookies that'll sometimes take like half or 3/4 of the summer to get them to really be like, now I get it.
Mm-hmm.
See that like magic, you know, sort of
yeah,
click.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, camp isn't for everybody. I mean, we, like I said, we, you know, we know based on research that, you know, being outside and being in structured environments where you're doing positive things and engaging in teamwork is good for literally every kind of kid.
Right.
That's why they have camps for, you know, kids that are special needs. They've got camps of for geared towards every conceivable demographic you could think of.
Yeah.
So we should get more kids there.
Yeah. So I want to pivot a little bit and change gears and talk about some of your other things.
Okay.
Pick one. Draw a paper out of a hat and pick one.
I guess.
So you were. So I'm gonna pull this in.
Sure.
You were recently an assistant teacher, student teacher.
Yeah. I student taught at Career Magnet High School.
My stomping grounds. Mm-hmm. My former stomping grounds. Yep. Class of I won't disclose.
Class of after mine.
Class
don't worry
of
about
I
it.
Will not disclose. tell me a little bit about like that experience, because I mean, really, jack of all trades is certainly, I think, a title that you deserve, but there's an underpinning to most of this.
Sure.
And I think the underpinning is obvious. It's, you know, educating and, you know, fostering relationships with children, teaching children lifelong lessons, yada, 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 mm-hmm. yada, right? Working with youth. Tell me about, like, what were the parallels that you saw in these incredibly different, right, like, atmospheres and in these incredibly different settings. What were the parallels that you saw?
I think no matter, you know, really what a kid's background is, and I think the thing that I like about teaching is, as an adult, if you can really invest yourself in it, it's actually kind of nice to feel needed. And so many of these kids, ranging in age, and I mean, you know, from like the 7-year-olds that I work with at camp to the teenagers I was working with at the high school, mm-hmm. to the, you know, 18 plus that I teach at UNH, more people need people in their lives that care and are willing to like take a little bit of risk to invest in them.
Yeah.
And it can often, you can often end up falling on your face trying to do that, mm-hmm. because you know, commit, you go the extra mile for a kid that doesn't want it or doesn't need it or just doesn't know enough to care at the moment. But that's something I've seen in every environment in which education has been a place, even in the military.
Mm.
Like, I would say that the common thing is I really enjoy the process of getting to know the people that I'm working with and the people that I'm trying to teach, you know, and finding like an angle where I get to be a part of making their life a little bit better in mm-hmm. some often minuscule, almost non-existent way. That it's selfish. It's inherently super selfish. People are always like, oh, teachers are so selfless. No, like it actually feels really, really good to feel like you had a positive impact on a kid.
Yeah.
It's like one of the best, like you see like teachers, right? They always talk about how like, I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase in your line of work, but like car cry days.
Yes.
Car cries. Yeah. Like, I remember having car cries, like, and just feeling like a lesson totally failed, or you didn't connect with a kid, or a kid really like let you down that you invested in, and it's just emotionally devastating. Or you have a lesson or a moment or a connection that like really resonates, and it fills you up like with just this like overwhelming. I feel like I'm like skipping on the way out to the parking lot, and that to me is the common, I think. And I know that's a super hokey, cheesy answer.
No, I think that's perfect. I think,
but it's
right. I mean, and I think it, right. Like, if more of us chose professions that did that to us, I think that we would be happier as a society. Right. I think that people in other countries choose professions that do that to them, and they are a softer, happier society.
And we don't, and unfortunately in our country, we don't do a super great job of encouraging it. You know, like I remember thinking about the nonprofit sector when I was like an undergrad and just being told like, well, you know, like, hey, well, say goodbye to making a decent living. And I was, and now I've come to find out that's not true at all. You can actually make a very, very healthy living mm-hmm. in the nonprofit sector.
Yeah.
And you can actually, they're like, oh, you can have your cake. Yeah, you can. You can have your cake and eat it too. You can actually
have a job. I
just
don't even know why that phrase is a
it's
thing.
It's so stupid.
Why would I make a cake if I'm not going to
eat it? Yeah, I'm not giving it to somebody else.
I put all the work in this cake.
But yeah, I mean, you can have a job that makes you feel good. And it doesn't even have to be necessarily in the nonprofit sector. I guess it's just the example I'm more familiar with. But like, and what's better than that? if you can actually make a decent living for yourself and feel really good and genuinely rewarded by what you do, like, then there's the question is like, well, what more can you ask for?
Exactly.
I guess have multiple jobs like that.
Well, I mean, so speaking of multiple jobs, right now you are Mowgli Ing.
Yep, Mowgli Ing full time, and then
UNHing part time.
Yep. I was teaching two classes this past semester. I'll be teaching just one this coming spring. I'm building a new course actually on nonprofit fundraising. I'm still relatively new to the game, but I'm helping to sort of coordinate putting together this class and bringing in experts from other local nonprofits like in New Haven to come and speak about fundraising. And
who do you have coming in?
So I've put a lot of feelers out. I haven't gotten a ton of replies back, mostly because we're 2 weeks out from the end of the new year. And unless I'm offering to give them money, no self-respecting development director cares about anything right now until the end of the year, especially with upcoming potential tax changes.
Right. Mm. Word. Mm. Yeah. So Mowgli-ing, UNHing, handymanning.
Yep.
Tell me a bit about that.
So I've always really just liked, actually your partner, put it very aptly that I've sort of been like training my entire life to own my own home. I love
that's like I do have to say, like, you know, training all your life is like it connotates an event that is like a moment in time. But I've been training my whole life to own a home, which is like not an event, it is
an experience.
It is an active practice.
That's what I love about it. Like, I love so I grew up in more rural part of New Hampshire. My dad was a super, you know, handy guy. I mean, and he taught me, even when I didn't want to, taught me how to do all, I mean, plumbing and electrical and carpentry and working on cars and all that stuff. And as the older I've gotten, the more I've come to appreciate it and the more I've sort of found certain areas of it that I find really interesting, you know, woodworking and whatever. And it's just something I really like doing. And throughout my life, I've always found a need to make a little extra cash here and there. And I've always been amazed at what people don't necessarily know how to do. And so, yeah, you know, maybe it's coming over and helping you fix that leaky toilet or, you know, putting up a fence in your backyard, landscaping, painting, carpentry, whatever. And I can't, you know, honestly, at this point, I don't have enough time to squeeze in as many of them as because now I'm doing it to my own house, which is really fulfilling. Although I don't seem to make any money doing it.
No.
I've been trying to get Liz to pay me, but she's not. She's not into it.
Yeah. You should reach out to some donors to see if you can
see if I can get a grant for redoing my bathroom or something. I like that. But yeah, so I've been doing that for basically. I had my first business in high school. I was like 15. I was working as like a dishwasher at this crappy restaurant, and I started a business where, like, during study hall, I would go out into the parking lot and put in stereos. People's cars.
Oh, wow.
So I would swap out, you know, their
New Haven of you.
I know. You were meant to move in rural here. In rural New Hampshire. Yeah, it was great. To,
That is a New Haven style side hustle.
And I don't know. I remember that was like right at the beginning of like Vistaprint. I remember like getting like really cheap, crappy business cards made.
That's
like,
funny.
It was, yeah.
So a moment ago, you said you'd be surprised about what people don't know how to do. Mm. Surprise us.
Okay, so I should preface this by saying that I'm an incredibly stubborn person, and I can't really think of much.
I'll co-sign that.
Anything that I would like willingly pay another person to do, even like often as my fiance regularly reminds me, like bordering on genuinely unsafe behavior. And getting just massively over my head with various projects. I've had friends. I mean, as you know, my friends often will call me when something random breaks and they need a second opinion on something or whatever, cars, whatever. So I have had friends who I've, you know, made the joke about the headlight fluid joke. You ever heard the headlight fluid joke?
No.
So back in the day, you know, joke was like, oh, you know, oh, yeah. Oh, your headlight's out. Oh, yeah. You can bring to the mechanic. Make sure they check the headlight fluid, right? Obviously, headlights don't have fluid in them. Except,
learn something new every day.
You'd be surprised how few people know that. You'd be genuinely surprised. Or, like, with cars, for example, like, your car could be making like increasingly weird noises, and you'd be amazed how much people just ignore them. They'll ignore them till something plain old just falls off. Liz, my fiance, thinks I'm nuts because whenever I'm driving around in our in the truck or whatever, I'll hear every little ticking noise. I'll be like, I gotta like get underneath it and see what it is. I mean, something as simple as like, okay, your faucet's leaking. Have you tried just tightening it?
Yeah.
You know, I'm a huge proponent of like YouTube. And I love that, you know, you'd be like, okay, my
YouTube University, shout out.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's like, I love that, like, okay, maybe your toilet's leaking, right? And you could go and pay $150 and have a plumber come in, literally just take a wrench, tighten it up, right? Or you could go on YouTube and look at like the hundreds of thousands of videos out there that show you how to troubleshoot something like that. But I think a lot of time people just don't have the patience necessarily, or even just the time to like learn a new skill outside of, and I want to throw a question at you. Do you feel like
my heart stopped a little bit?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm gonna
must be how Terry Gross feels when her guest turns around and goes, "What do you think about that, Terry?" I'm like, "What? I wasn't prepared. I didn't study for this."
She's usually got good answers. Dude, you got a high bar.
I know. Oh my gosh.
So, I've often had the feeling that, you know, folks are increasingly specialized. You know, so you come out of college and you're like, okay, I know how to do engineering and really nothing else. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And now, granted, that's like purely anecdotal, but I've...
No, that's my partner all the way.
Right? So it's like, so it's something I think about, like, is that something you've encountered in talking with people that like maybe what you're seeing are the types of folks that don't like to just do one thing? They want to be able to experience multiple...
So no, I think you're right, and it might very well be just the way we've designed our education factories, which is sort of like, you know, in elementary school, right? You might not be really great at math. You might be good at reading, right? Like, and so let me do more in this course to intrigue you, which is not bad,
no.
Right? But what that turns into is, in middle school, right, you start veering away from math more and more, and more towards reading. This is a story of self, by the way. and right now there was a hard turning point in third grade. I always say this. Do you remember recess?
Yeah.
So I was Gretchen when it came to math in third grade. Mm-hmm. I was like, my teacher, I went to Barnard, my teacher, Mrs. Simpson, I will never forget. She used to call me up to the class after asking everyone else to follow the thing. And I would like swag on the court, like, and take out a piece of chalk and like both hands, just knock out this problem. Fourth grade wasn't so great. Fifth grade was increasingly bad, right? Like, and sixth, seventh, and eighth, I was like, okay, well, math is not for me. And that was accompanied with a lot of coercion from those who were supposed to be sort of equitably teaching me each subject. By the time I got to high school, I didn't even want to count.
Nope.
Right? Like, by the time you
get to like algebra and stuff, and you're like, no.
Yeah, no, this isn't for me.
I'm just going to take AP English three times.
And see if I can get the credit from that. And what I will say is, this is live, so this is a thing, but what I will say is, it wasn't that I was unable to do math. In fact, I was still almost inherently really good at math. I was just super discouraged. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to put the work into it. Mm-hmm. When I got to, it must have been algebra one in high school. My teacher, Mrs. Peng, out at Career, she was just like, she must have seen that I was just inherently good. I was natural in math. She like pulls me aside and goes, I would absolutely endorse you going straight to geometry or even to algebra two if you want, like that. I'd be happy to do that for you. And I was like, yeah, I don't know about that. I'm not really good at math, because that's what I've been hearing for years.
Sure.
Right. And
you segmented yourself
exactly
as a, you know, to sort of deal with that. Yeah.
Right. So now, to your point, I am narrowed into this field that I've created, which is like communications, which is a segue from reading, which is, if I had to guess, a segue from all of those reading courses and mm-hmm. classes that I've had to take over the language arts and yada yada yada, that teachers like, oh, you're really good at this. And then also a segue away from the fact that people were saying or nurturing me away from math. So I think you're right. Most of the people that I talk to are specialized, and they're not a jack of all trades, which is what I think is really good about cool about your story, especially as the final story for the year. For those listening, let me just reset real quick. You're listening to Work It Out with Mercy Quay on WNHH Radio, broadcasting live at 103.5 FM and live streaming at newhavenindependent.org and also the New Haven Independent, the New Haven Independent's Facebook page. I'm here with James Hart. And I was just saying that, especially to close up the year, and for everyone listening, this is the last show for the year, and we won't be back until January 8th. I think it's a really good way to end the year, an episode that is just a relatable story, right? Someone finding, right, like a relatable guy. I hesitate to say an average Joe because nothing you do is average, but like
that's very nice of you to say. No.
But like a relatable guy, just doing fitting pieces together to work it out.
Well, and I just wanted to add like just a little bit, like in terms of like my background, like I went to college and dropped out because I ran out of money.
Oh,
and I joined the army because
I didn't know that
I needed money. Oh. Like I was 3/4 of the way through a bachelor's degree.
So that's how
degree.
They get you.
And joined the army, did that for 5 years. And don't get me wrong, that was actually a pretty incredible experience for me.
The army.
But you have to, like, I don't know. I guess it's just, I think if I could impart anything from my own experience, and granted, there have been tons of flops, like failed business attempts, way too much time spent in retail. I mean, all kind of, like, joining the army without having no idea what I was doing. Like, I mean, there was plenty of missteps along the way. But I think if I could throw anything out for people to just kind of give a try to, I know, you know, this is the time, as you were, I know you're saying, you're thinking about doing a piece about New Year's resolutions and stuff. And I always find that people, I think one of the mistakes people make is they make them way too lofty. They're like, yeah, I'm going to lose 60 pounds or whatever. And it's like, I'm gonna run a marathon. No, you're not. You're not. Because if you were, you would have already run one by now. Sorry. But no, I think if I could give anybody anything, it would be just like try to learn something that's outside of your scope. Mm. And it doesn't, like, for me, like, it's fixing things. Like, I love, you know, if I don't know how to do something, I go, I just make it until it's
you're sort
not
of a
awful.
Tinkerer in that
I
way.
Love, yeah, I mean, I love having my little shop in the basement and mess around with things. But it could be anything. It could be, like, learning to cook something or bake something, learning to anything where you get, like, an end result that is sort of concretely yours. I think is something that for me is very, very fulfilling. You know, when I take like a crappy piece of wood and can make it into something that's cute or useful or whatever, that's it's really, really rewarding. And that's why I like cooking too. It's why I like gardening. I like all those, you know, because you get to make something and it's yours and you get to look at it and feel good about it. And that's...
Yeah. So one of the questions that I ask every guest that comes on the show is what gets you worked up? Now, you're talking about a lot of things...
Worked up? You mean like is that like a pun? Is that your catchphrase? Get worked up?
Get worked up. Yeah.
I like that. Okay.
Work it out, get worked up. What gets you worked up? So you're talking a lot about tinkering and you're talking a lot about, right, like learning new things. What is the one thing of all the things that you do, right? Like a dude of all trades, what is the one thing of all of the things that you do that actually just really gets you worked up?
Something new. Mm. Like something that I don't know how to do yet. Mm. And getting to learn about it. Like that is... Like in education, we always talk about like lifelong learners. Mm-hmm. And like, I think I'm very much a product of that. Mm. The other day, I got really, really excited, way, way more excited, worked up, if you will, about learning like everything there is to know about IRS tax benefits of in-kind gifts. Which is, I mean, not fun. Reading through, it's not.
You were about to say awesome, and
I genuinely enjoyed it. I genuinely did. I was like, okay, I walked into something knowing very little about it and walked out of it feeling like I have at least a foundational understanding and can, like, you know,
there's something productive that. About that. Whereas, like, what gets me worked up, if I were to use that same thing, like learning something new, I find myself in, like, these midnight spirals of Google searching things that, like, at the end of the 2 hours that I've wasted, I'm like, how did I get here?
It's like a black hole of learning,
yeah, absolutely.
Like a rabbit hole of learning. Yeah, yeah, totally.
Except what I'm learning is probably not as productive as what you're learning. At some point, like, I'm just finding out why Nicole Richie lost 50 pounds in 2012.
Hey, trust me, plenty of mine go into, like, who, like, where did the guy get that shirt from in that movie? Like, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. That's part of the equation, too. But
that's awesome. And to wrap up, because this is the end of the year, we're heading into Christmas, we're heading into the new year. What are some of the things that make you happy? And then what are some of the pieces of advice that you would give to those who are trying to work out happiness in their lives?
I would say, in terms of happiness, I'm two big things. So I'm just really happy this year. My fiance and I worked really hard and we bought a house.
Congratulations again.
And more importantly, I'm getting married. Which I know someone else is as well. Those are my, like, big happiness things.
Was
I
that
think.
Tacky? Should I not have done that?
No, that's fine.
Just do it twice for good measure.
I don't have mine yet, so. So in terms of advice, I'm going to go back to what I said before, which is, like, I think it's important to set goals for yourself.
Yeah.
And it's important to be deliberate. But it's more important, I think, to set goals that are feasible. Mm. Like, don't that you'd be like, all right, I'm going vegan if you eat bacon twice a week. Like, that's not
I
a
love
good.
That
like,
going that's not vegan a, is not feasible.
It's not, like, maybe it is for some people, but it's not for you.
Man.
And, like, so, like, when you look, if you're trying to set, like, maybe, like, a weight loss goal or something, like, if you put yourself in a corner with unreasonable expectations, do it step by step.
Yeah.
Get there, because you got to get there at your own pace. I was not expecting to be starting a career at 32.
Mm-hmm.
But that's basically what I'm doing, and I'm actually okay with it, and I feel really good about the direction that it's going, and it's because I took the steps. When I had the mistakes, I had a reasonable bit to make up,
yeah,
instead of having to, like, totally start over.
Yeah,
and I'm actually feels pretty good. I'm pretty happy with where I'm at. I just one step at a time.
That's awesome. I'm going to wrap it up there. Thank you again, James Hart, friend of mine, jack of all trades, working out at Magley, who, I would actually be remiss if I didn't say that Magley had a connection to Yale. Can you just, like, in 15 seconds, tell us what that connection to Yale is?
A lot of alumni. Our original director, our first, one of our first earliest directors, yeah, I mean, we've had just that's the main thing.
Yeah. Oh, big did you guys, like, share a lot of, like, tradition or things like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Just early days, lots of Harvard Yale competition. Which, oh, now that's why the camp we have red and blue.
And oh,
it was originally Harvard and Yale.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Happy I asked that. Again, thank you for listening to Work It Out with Mercy Quay. Thank you to my guest.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. James Hart, jack of all trades. Before I head out for the last time this year, what I will say is happy holidays. And I'm saying happy holidays specifically, not because I'm afraid of what you celebrate, but because there's a lot of crap to celebrate. Right? So don't come for me when I say happy holidays. Happy holidays to everyone who celebrates anything. I for one, I'm celebrating Christmas, but I'm also celebrating another rotation around the sun, another successful rotation around the sun. So please say happy holidays to me, because I got a lot of crap going on. And when we come back, July, all of the J months, January 8th, when we come back on January 8th, that will be the kickoff of fail month. So I am interviewing folks who have found some sort of failure in their lives, took a huge jump and failed, and have still sort of found their own brand of happiness and success from that. And if that is you, please feel free to reach out to me, Mercy A. Quay, on Facebook.com or at my email at mercy.quay@gmail.com. Going out for the last time this year. Again, happy holidays. Mercy Quay with Work It Out. Have a good one. Yeah, my money insane, player. Yeah, I'm making it rain, player. But I was just on a plane, player. Buying gear, flying here. It ain't what you heard, it's my time of year. If I'm in the club, I get 100 stacks. I'm always so I can love for that. I heard he stole my swag, but I don't want it back. I was on this, but now I'm on to that. You see it in my closet before it's on the rack. Was out there in Hawaii, now I'm going back.